At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It lays off 12,000 workers, announces its loan business is down almost 20%, and yet today Countrywide Financial somehow comes up with another $12 billion to play with in the mortgage markets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Thursday, the 13th of September. Glad to have you with us. If you had to put a face on the subprime mess and all the ensuing problems the finance markets have been having, Countrywide would be a pretty safe choice. It's headlined the liquidity crunch almost from the beginning. But get this, Countrywide shares spiked almost 14% today on that news that it's gotten its hands on another $12 billion. Its banks are, in essence, throwing out a lifeline. We asked Marketplace's Lisa Napoli to explain why.
Countrywide's already plowed through an $11.5 billion credit line. Mortgage industry analyst Tom LaMalfa says giving it another $12 billion in credit may seem like throwing good money after bad, but he says it's a necessary life preserver.
I mean, if Countrywide goes, they were the number one lender in the country.
LaMalfa says banks are eager to extend the credit to Countrywide. He says no one wants to see a company go belly up that in the first half of this year did 1 in 5 of the nation's home loans. Last month, Bank of America was just as eager to buy a $2 billion stake in Countrywide on the promise of a better future. Now, what kind of a future could a company as troubled as Countrywide have? Analysts like LaMalfa say actually, potentially, a bright one, if it can ride out the storm.
It will extend their life through the end of the year. How much beyond that, I'm not sure.
Subprimes may taint Countrywide's portfolio, but they only make up 10% of the company's business. Access to cash will allow it to keep doing what it's been doing for 30 years, make loans. Mortgage industry consultant Howard Glazer says banks have faith in Countrywide's ability to recover.
So really their challenge is to get past this transitional period, and then they can end up on top of the new mortgage market as it emerges from the clouds 6 months down the line.
After all, subprime lending may be in big trouble, but the plain Jane fixed-rate mortgage has long been Countrywide stock and trade. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Bank of America is already making money on that $2 billion that it pumped into Countrywide, but there are plenty of other opportunities to cash in on the credit crunch. Here's one that's in the news today. Distressed debt. It sounds a bit like debt that's been stonewashed and strategically ripped so it can be sold for way more than it's worth. But it may just be the hot new investment out there. We learned this morning the giant money manager PIMCO has launched a $2 billion distressed debt fund. It'll invest in mortgage-backed securities and some other fancy finance creations. And yes, those are the very things that got us into this whole credit mess to begin with. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
They're known as vulture funds. They feed on junk bonds close to default and other so-called distressed securities. The Wall Street Journal reports that PIMCO is the latest money manager hoping to pick over the remains left by the subprime mortgage meltdown. Mike Hatley is president of Westgate Horizons Advisors. He says as traditional investors shun risky bonds and loans, speculators are snapping them up at fire sale prices with the promise of high returns.
There's definitely potentially a lot of money to be made because a lot of these securities, there's nothing wrong with them. It's just there's a lot of it for sale and not a whole lot of buyers right now.
Hatley's firm sells pools of corporate loans to investors. With PIMCO in the game, he's hoping the debt market will pick up. But PIMCO is taking on some risk if the credit market doesn't bounce back. The firm is reportedly betting on the same kinds of investments that got two hedge funds at Bear Stearns in so much trouble this summer. King Penniman analyzes the corporate debt market at KDP Investment Advisors. He says it'll take investors like PIMCO to spark a recovery.
I think what we have to find is new non-traditional buyers to try and clear the market and bring it back to balance, and this is certainly an important step to get there.
PIMCO isn't the first company to dip its toe into the market. Several investment firms have launched funds that focus on troubled securities, and investment bankers say they're staffing up to cope with the trading volume. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was a report out from the United Nations today on infant mortality. UNICEF says the number of children dying each year has dropped below 10 million for the first time since it began keeping records. It stands to reason that more widespread public health campaigns contributed to that decline. But Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, healthier economies make for healthier kids, too.
UNICEF launched a campaign to save children's lives 25 years ago through simple methods. The fund pushed widespread vaccinations and treatments for diarrhea. They also encouraged breastfeeding rather than bottles and delivered clean water. Carol Stern of the US Fund for UNICEF says these interventions work, but they're more successful in some countries than others.
The stronger the economy, the stronger the support, the stronger our ability to sustain a program.
Michael Kramer teaches international development at Harvard. He says improving economies are vitally important to save kids' lives.
Well, one factor is the tremendous economic growth in China and to a lesser extent in India. As the societies get richer, that both allows households to afford better care for their children and it allows governments to make bigger investments.
Kramer says as economies improve, women have fewer children. They can feed and educate them better. But he warns that these improvements aren't automatic. Countries must choose to support and accept these international programs. Kramer says India and China, as well as Latin America and some places in Africa, have done that. UNICEF's Carol Stern stresses how cheap things like mosquito nets and clean water are.
$1 provides clean drinking water to 40 people for a day, or to one child for 40 days, you know, depending on how you want to base the equation.
Even more children should survive as new vaccines for pneumonia and diarrhea are more widely available, and groups like the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB and Malaria and the Gates Foundation expand their reach. Part of it's raising awareness. Mosquito nets alone could save the lives of 1 million kids every year. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Today was the second day this week Big Macs in Detroit helped send the Dow Industrials higher. The NASDAQ and the S&P went along for the ride, all that despite oil at $80.09 a barrel at the close in New York. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you spent any time at all in front of a television set this summer, you probably saw more than your fair share of game shows. Old favorites like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and Jeopardy. New ones like America's Got Talent and The Singing Bee. And then the one that wonders whether you're smarter than a fifth grader.
The $2,000 question is, if Jacob stands on Spencer's shoulders, they are 2.5 yards high. How many feet is that?
Well, let's see, 3 feet in a yard times 2.5, I don't know.
7.5 is the correct answer. And you're leaving here with nothing.
Contestants sometimes leave with nothing, but rest assured, networks and show producers are winning big, which might explain why we're seeing so many more game shows now. Greg Siegel's with Baseline Studio Systems. That's a film and television information broker. Greg, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm almost afraid to say this, but we've been in reality show land for what seems like years and years now. Are we getting into game show land here eventually?
I think in some respects we're still there. I think we're still in reality land. I just don't think they're doing what they used to do. I don't think they can depend on reality like they used to. And I think the current crop of game shows is basically the evolution of where we're going with that reality genre.
What's the attraction? Is it that they're just so cheap to produce?
They're cheap to produce. I think they're really accessible to the average audience. They're not complicated shows. They're, you know, smarter than a fifth grader isn't, they're not asking tough questions, but there's something the audience can participate at home and be a part of and really get from coast to coast, not just on either end. We're talking middle of the country too, which is important.
In the primetime opportunity this fall, what are we going to see as far as new game shows?
The fall, I don't think you're going to see a lot of new game shows. I think what you're going to see is the returning of the successful game shows, Deal or No Deal. Power of 10 just got picked up for another 6 episodes.
Remind me what that one is.
Power of 10,
tell me, since I know that.
Drew Carey hosts it now that, you know, this. I think he got a little bit of fuel from his Price is Right deal.
Mm-hmm. He takes over from Bob Barker.
Yeah, he starts on October on that one, but that's the daytime version. Power of 10 is basically just that quizzy kind of game show, but the prize money is where it's attractive.
Does originality get you anything? It just seems like a lot of these shows are just copycats of some of the old classics.
I think we've seen this in a pattern with reality shows as well, is there aren't a lot of original concepts. There are a lot of riffs on old concepts. I mean, game shows have been around since the beginning of television. They're not new. Keeping in mind also, a lot of these shows are formats imported from another country. There's a new one that just came out from Three Ball Productions with J.D. Roth. They do Biggest Loser. They just ordered The Interrogator, I believe, and that might be the new crop is lie detector shows, whether you can tell the people are lying or not. And they took an element of, I believe, a Dutch format and are incorporating that into the American version of the show.
Is there some risk for producers of these shows? I mean, if somebody actually wins $1 million, the producers have to pony up $1 million, don't they?
The producers will have to pony up $1 million, but the fact of the matter is they plan on that. They want people to win. They just don't want people to win a lot.
Right.
But they have insurance policies in place.
Oh, is that
they
right?
They take out insurance if they hit it. Again, just to bring up Price is Right, the $1 million spectacular primetime episodes that they bring back every now and then as a special, that's exactly what they do. They have an insurance policy. I believe Who Wants to Be a Millionaire also took out policies when they lost big.
And I bet if networks keep having to pay out, then that show's not going to be on the air for too much longer, is it?
Well, not necessarily. If they get the numbers, they're going to keep it on the air. But what they do also, if it's a quiz show particularly, they can actually tweak the questions to make them harder or easier. So they cast these for people who fit the profile. They're not casting necessarily for your smartest guy. They're casting for the most interesting player.
Right.
So let's say that person's not doing so well, but they feel they can get a little mileage. They can actually make the questions harder or easier to get to direct that inevitable end. They may be able to get someone off the air quicker based on that.
All right. Isn't that kind of, I don't know, cheating?
No, I don't. I mean, it's an element of controlling the game without cheating.
In essence, dynamic scoring, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Greg Siegel is the managing TV editor at Baseline Studio Systems here in Los Angeles. Greg, thanks a lot for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Coming up, working far from home definitely has its downsides.
Oprah had on it, for optimum health, you need to have sex 200 times a year. He's only home 40 days a year.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 133 points today, exactly 1%, to finish at 13,424. The Nasdaq advanced 8 points, a third of 1%, closing at 2601. The S&P 500 up 12, 0.8%, wrapped up the trading day at 1483. Financial stocks led the way thanks to signs that credit is becoming perhaps easier to find. Goldman Sachs climbed 3.25%. J.P. Morgan Chase rose 2.5%. General Motors got a brand new paint job from investors today. The stock shined up 10% on an upgrade from an analyst. Ford rolled ahead more than 5.5%. Chrysler, oh no, that's private now, isn't it, these days? McDonald's was loving it again today. Its stock price, that is, shares of Mickey D's hit an all-time record during the day and cooked up more than 6% at the close. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. By Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of August. The Center for Science and the Public Interest holds a forum at the National Press Club on making school foods more nutritious. And the X Conference opens in Washington, not extreme sports, but extraterrestrials. The agenda focuses on the political, governmental, and social aspects relating to extraterrestrial-related phenomena. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Umberto bit into South Texas and Louisiana last night with rain and 80-mile-an-hour winds. The first hurricane to hit this country in 2 years wasn't anything like Katrina. It had petered into a tropical storm by mid-morning. We've got another couple of months yet until hurricane season officially ends on November 30th. And commentator Marcellus Andrews says it could still get worse for those who live in harm's way.
The basic economics of risk in hurricane zones is crystal clear. The only people who should live in killer storm zones are those who can afford very expensive insurance and stormproof housing. But what about the millions of poor and working people who can't afford either, but are essential to coastal economies? We could provide them with subsidies so that they could afford insurance. But we don't have to. Instead, we can safely gamble that sheer economic necessity will bully our soldiers, police, construction workers, and daycare providers into accepting their exposure to Mother Nature. But do we really want to bet that we can tear up the social contract and maintain social order? Business reality demands it. It's cheaper for society to rescue disaster survivors after the fact than protect them from nature's nastiness. Social unrest? Yes. We'll have that, but not riots or radical politics. These people are simply powerless at work and in politics. Profound alienation. Sure, we'll have legions of migrants as climate change proceeds. Continually displaced populations will commit more crimes. Prisons will be the warehouses for these climate migrants. Impossible? No. Think Mexico City, Mumbai, Nairobi, Sao Paulo, Cairo. There, elites maintain enough distance between themselves and everybody else that they don't have to give a darn about the majority living at the mercy of the weather. I have no idea what will happen in an urban society, in an advanced capitalist country, with a large, floating population continually displaced by climate risk. But neither does anybody else. It's another step in globalization, where the U.S. begins to join the third world. And that's why this is a bad, bad bet.
Economist Marcellus Andrews lives in New York City. Send us your thoughts online. Our website is marketplace.org. Once you strip away big business and multinational conglomerates, what you have left is the building block of the global economy, the individual worker. Today on our monthly series, Working, Chris Brooks brings us the story of Canadian oil worker Blair Gent. Most of Canada's crude is out west in the oil sands of Alberta. Blair, though, lives in Newfoundland, on the other side of the country. He makes that long commute alone, but he's not the only one dealing with the hardships.
Brody, trying to get up my baby.
Why?
It's 2:30 in the morning when 10-year-old Brody Gent opens his eyes to see his father with his bag packed, ready to drive to the airport.
All right, baby, let's go.
Brody lives with his parents in Harbour Mill, Newfoundland, a tiny community of just 182 souls tucked into the Atlantic coast of Canada. But his dad is going to work on the other side of the continent.
I'm Blair Gent, industrial mechanic.
With chronic unemployment in Harbour Mill, this quiet 39-year-old commutes all the way to Alberta, 3,000 miles away.
It's not so bad if you're young and got no family, but when you're tied down and got to pay the bills.
Blair's wife, Pam, and Brody slip in beside him for the three-hour drive up the coast to the airport, keeping their eyes peeled for any moose that might suddenly dart out of the blackness and cross the highway. After tonight, the family won't be together again for nearly 2 months.
Anybody who works in oil patch, it's hard on family. There's lots of divorces. And 3 or 4 years ago, we were working just outside Calgary, and out of like maybe 50 guys, I think I was the only one left married.
Would you think of moving the family up to Fort McMurray?
Not a chance. You know, scenario of every boom town, it's hard and fast, and there's a lot of hard elements, and family life is way better down here.
If you can call it family life, last year, Blair was away for 6 months straight. Right now, he's on a 6-2 rotation. 6 weeks in Alberta, two home with Brody and Pam.
You know, Oprah had on it for optimum health, you need to have sex 200 times a year. He's only home. 40 days a year. So we're going to die early.
Okay. A quick curbside goodbye at the airport at 4 a.m. Blair steps onto his flight to Fort McMurray. 8 hours from now, and he'll start his day installing instrumentation controls on the oil sands site, the maze of remote sensing transmitters that monitor things like pressure and flow rate for the oil extraction process.
You got everything ashore?
His nights will be a bunk in a company-owned work camp. Pam and Brody start their long drive back to Harbour Mill in the dark. Theirs is the flip side of Blair's long-distance job, making the family function while he's away. It's Pam Gent's work, and it starts now.
What?
What's wrong?
Nothing's wrong.
Well, I know something's wrong. What is it?
Well, you know, just dropping your dad off. Kind of sad, don't you think?
Yeah.
You guess.
Back in Harbour Mill, Pam runs a small grocery store. It's the only store in town, but a tiny community with only 77 mailboxes can't give them enough business to make ends meet.
There's a lot of hope that the store will do better, so there won't be as much of a need for him to work away. But, I mean, right now, economically, we do need that money.
There's kind of a sad irony running underneath this work situation that Pam and Blair find themselves in. Up until 3 years ago, they both had dream jobs in Toronto, working 9 to 5, and the family was together every night.
Financially, it couldn't have been better. We had the big house and the big mortgage and the two vehicles.
But then, a couple of things happened. Back in Harbour Mill, Pam's grandmother died and left her house. And then, one day in Toronto,
I came home from work, you know, picked my son up from daycare, started supper, and on the news, it had this little girl was missing off a street, and this wasn't too far from where we lived. Even though I could see and hear my son outside playing from my kitchen, I just instinctively went in and grabbed him and brought him in and locked the door. And that was the very first time that I felt fear. And then the news just got worse. The next day they found her body parts. She had been... It was horrible. So then we just made plans. We put the house on the market, and we were coming home.
Home to this little fishing village with a beach and a perfect swimming hole, a great place to bring kids up in. But
Blair has to work away. We keep thinking that the work away is a temporary thing, but this has been going on now since 2004 for us.
The Alberta time zone is 3.5 hours away, so the family stays in touch through voice messaging and phone calls in the wee hours when Blair's back in his bunk.
Your call has been forwarded to TELUS Mobility Voice Messaging Center. Blair, Jen. Not available. At the tone, please record your message.
Hi, Blair, it's me. I just got home. So let me call if you get back, okay? Bye.
On Father's Day, it's 5 a.m. in Alberta.
Hello?
Hello, boy.
Hey, Dad.
How are you doing?
Okay.
Don't forget
what
you gotta wish him.
Happy Father's Day, Dad.
Thank you.
Half asleep phone conversations like this are often what the father-son relationship consists of while Blair's away. Pam works hard to make up for it.
I'm not gonna pretend today's not Father's Day. If Blair was here, we'd probably do a beach bonfire. We'd have scallops. Scallops is Blair's favorite meal. We're doing all those things because I wanted to make sure that it's a special day for Brody and that he doesn't feel lost, because one of his little friends, his father, came home on his 8-day rotation and happens to be here today for Father's Day, and that's Brody's best friend.
Here, I'll want you to wash your hair tonight.
I did last night.
Thanks for your help. You're really a big help. So where do you think Dad is? Tell me where the provinces
are.
Yeah, and what city?
I don't know.
Fort McMurray.
I've been with Blair since I was 16 years old. And the very first time that we lived together was on a single bed. And that single bed had room enough for two more people. We were that close. And that's how we slept for a lot of years, that close. When Blair started going away, you get used to sleeping on your own. And now when he comes home, he has a spare bed and he goes out there. And actually, it was kind of funny this time home. One of the first things he said to me was, "Oh, it's so nice to have my bed back." His bed is the spare bed.
Message marked urgent.
Hi, Lee. Hope everybody does well. Can you call later, okay? All right. Bye-bye.
End of message.
So I don't know. By the time we get content with having him back, he'll be gone. We'll be discontent with him gone for the first little time. Just as we get content again, he comes home. And then I have to accept him, and he has to accept me. And everything is jumbled up, and then the cycle starts all over again.
It starts over again at airport arrivals, with Pam dolled up in a low-cut sweater, holding a cup of takeout coffee for Blair.
Where are you?
After an 8-hour flight, Blair appears in a fresh-pressed shirt, clean-shaven, smelling of aftershave.
This must be your come-home shirt, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. It's the only one clean.
The little things that show how much they welcome this part of the cycle. And Blair will be home long enough to paint the porch and fix the vacuum cleaner and maybe go fishing with his son. And then Pam will drive him back to the airport and they'll each head back to their two separate worlds, home and work. Pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that should fit together, but don't.
You never called me today. I thought you were calling my friend.
It was a direct flight, 8 hours.
You said Calgary, I think.
Yeah, for 15 minutes.
Chris Brooks in Canada for us. His report was part of our series, Working. It's a co-production with Homelands Productions. For more on the Gent family and other workers that we've profiled in the series, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you'll be hearing from former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan ad nauseum over the next couple of days. His memoirs coming out on Monday, in case you hadn't heard. So he's making the media rounds. He's already taped his segment for this weekend's 60 Minutes, which released some prime quotes today to pump up their publicity machine. Mr. Greenspan thinks the guy who took his job is doing just fine, thanks. And on the market topic of the moment, that is subprimes, he said he didn't really see it coming, that he didn't realize until late 2005 what a problem a real estate meltdown was going to be for the rest of us. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 133 points, 1%. The NASDAQ gained 8 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 up 12 points, 0.8% there. Our editors include John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, Japan embraces one of America's oldest rivalries.
He said that I'm a Red Sox fan and not a Yankee fan because I choose good over evil.
I don't know about that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.